and you're listening to a live call-in program on IPR News Radio about the future of Line 5. You can call in with your question. The number is 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. We have three guests with us right now to talk further. Garrett Ellison is a reporter with MLive who's been covering this story closely. Garrett, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jim Lively is the program director for Groundwork Center for Resilient Communities here in Northern Michigan. Jim, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, David.
And on the phone, we have Peter Langley. He is the executive director of the Associated Petroleum Industries of Michigan. Peter, thanks for calling in.
Thanks for having me today.
Garrett, I want to start with you. Ryan Duffy said in that interview that Enbridge thinks the alternatives report has validated a lot of what they've said about Line 5. What are your main takeaways from this enormous, long report?
Well, right now, I think one of the main takeaways is that it's still being digested, not just by Enbridge, but by folks like myself in the media, folks like Mr. Lively over here, Mr. Langley as well at API Michigan. It's a very long report, and it did in some ways seem to, seem deferential to Enbridge's position, and which I think is why you saw some of the protest come out against it yesterday before the contractors presented the report in Holt at Holt High School. David Holtz at Sierra Club called it the oil industry version of how to protect the Great Lakes. I think largely that was based on the risk assessment of a spill from the line, which was significantly less than what other risk assessments done by what the public considers to be a much less biased folks, not connected to Enbridge in any way. I think the University of Michigan did a big modeling of what a spill might look like. And I think the campaign against Enbridge, Line 5, is much more keen to see that assessment being used rather than the assessment that was put forth in the alternatives analysis. That really dominated a lot of the conversation at the meeting last night.
Jim, did you see it as deferential to Enbridge, this report?
Well, clearly, there was, these are oil industry contractors that were writing this report. They obviously have worked for Enbridge before, and they're intending to work for Enbridge again. So you can imagine they were wanting to make sure they were being, especially fair to their future customers, because that's where they're going to get their next job. So maybe not overly deferential. They clearly were trying last night to show that they were being independent. But I guess I'll say one of the big takeaways that Garrett didn't mention, although it was his headline this morning, is they definitely, although they were supposed to be working on alternatives, they defined the risk, and it is definitely a significant risk, much greater than zero, that we all know is there. And now we have a number to talk about, and it's more than I think most people in Michigan would be willing to accept.
Peter, what did you think of the report?
We're still trying to digest it, like Garrett said, and I think that there's a lot of information in there that needs to be reviewed a little bit further. I understand the opposition's perspective, thinking that it was deferential to Enbridge, but there's not a lot of great information in there for either side. What it is it's a factual basis for decision makers to figure out where to go to next. And in that sense, I think it's a very good report. I think I told Garrett last night that I thought it was outstanding. Now, the presentation was a little bit dry, but you had a whole bunch of engineers and operations guys talking through their findings and their assumptions and the modeling techniques that they used. And I think that's important to hear. But if you're not an industry expert or an engineer, it was tough to digest last night if that was the first time you were hearing it.
Peter, an engineer who worked on the report said that there's a 1 in 60 chance of the line breaking between now and 2053, which I think would be the century mark for the line, which was built in the 1950s. Is that an acceptable risk?
I don't think there's any acceptable risk. And I think as an industry, we work towards zero incidents. And that's a goal that API, American Petroleum Institute, who I work for, they are a standard-setting organization. They work towards zero risk, and they put into practice and procedure standards that move towards that goal. Technology is increasing at such a rate that, some of the tests that were available and some of the tests that they were talking about last night on that panel that they used 10 years ago have advanced to such a degree now that you can get much more precise readings. And I think that, as the industry goal, that's where we're working towards. So, you know, any risk is unacceptable, but at the same time, product has to move from where it's at to where the customers are. And I think that that's the discussion that needs to be had.
Jim, this report also says that the pipeline could operate indefinitely, that, aging is having little effect on the condition of the pipe itself. What do you make of that?
Well, they did talk an awful lot about the engineering aspects of how a pipeline can continue to be maintained underwater. But what they really focused on, and I think is was a little bit of a surprise to some of us, were the things that were not just corrosion, but that the real risks are things like the currents in the Straits of Mackinac that, if it's not anchored properly, could cause this, the pipeline to literally shake itself wide open and rupture, a full-bore open rupture. Or an anchor drag was considered the number one, a boat anchor.
What does that mean?
A boat anchor from one of the shipping freighters that goes through the Straits of Mackinac, quite a high frequency, could catch on to that pipeline and also rip it wide open. These were considered to be real, credible risks that have nothing to do with corrosion. It just has everything to do with the fact that we put a pipeline in the riskiest place of in the entire Great Lakes system. And it really, the only way to eliminate that risk is to eliminate the pipeline.
Peter, you know, that that bit about the pipeline being able to operate indefinitely, that's something that Enbridge has said repeatedly. I had an Enbridge vice president tell me that last summer when they invited me to go along with their with them on their last inspection of the pipeline. The PHMSA, the Federal Hazardous...
they're the regulatory agency.
Right. Yeah, they basically, well, if you look on their website, they say the same thing. It's an, if a pipeline is maintained properly, its lifespan is virtually endless. So within the pipeline industry and the regulatory community, at least at the federal level, there is a real belief that these pipelines can last forever if they're properly maintained. So it's a bit of a disconnect, I think, in some ways between the folks that seem to that are dealing with this, that the engineers that are evaluating these pipelines, evaluating the inspection reports, and then the folks you know, on the outside who are looking at this and they're saying, well, how can that be? Nothing lasts forever, especially a pipeline underwater. That just doesn't seem to make sense to a lot of people.
You're listening to go ahead, Peter. Go ahead.
I think that's a great point. It is a disconnect that's been created, and again, I'm not an engineer or a technical person, but from the reading of the report and some of the other instruments, some of the other items that are out there to read, it's structural integrity, which is the big factor in terms of operational success or failure, is it structurally sound? Is it being maintained and any issues being cleared up as they become apparent? And that to me was kind of an interesting point from last night's meeting, is that age really doesn't matter. It's structural integrity, and that's something that you can test for, and they have been testing since the late 80s. But it's a good point. It is an intellectual disconnect that is difficult to bridge.
You're listening to a live call-in program on IPR News Radio, and we want to hear from you this hour. Please call in with your question for this panel about Line 5. The number is 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. Garrett, what are some of the possible alternatives that were discussed in this report?
Well, there were several. Basically, the alternatives to, you know, the pipeline existing where it is that were contained in the report were: build a new pipeline elsewhere, build a new pipeline across the straits, either in a tunnel or dig a trench and bury it. those were, you know, what the report referred to as in proximity to the Straits. One of the alternatives, obviously, was just shutting down the line entirely and abandoning it. What they did not consider was taking the capacity, the oil and liquid natural gas that moves through the pipeline, and moving it through existing pipelines already in place elsewhere. So essentially the report did in some ways boil down to the choices are build a new pipeline under the Straits in some capacity. Build a new pipeline either around the southern end of Lake Michigan or the northern shore of Lake Superior, or shut the line down.
Jim, what did you make of these alternatives? Are they are any of them attractive to you?
Well, certainly the decommission alternative that was described, it was considered to be a feasible alternative. And I think one of the other headlines that we all heard last night was, should this pipeline be shut down, which we believe it should, that Michigan residents might see a 2.1-cent increase in gas prices. So we might see 2-cent increase if we shut this thing down. That might be the most significant impact to the Michigan residents. I think most residents would be comfortable with that. But if I could, I'd like to talk about the alternative that Garrett was just talking about, which is this existing infrastructure, because it was dismissed as not feasible.
And this is the idea that while couldn't Enbridge move, or couldn't some company move, you know, enough propane to Michigan to fulfill the need to meet the market
oil
need?
Yeah, this is really an oil pipeline, correct? The thing that was missed, and I think was a major flaw in the study, and I asked this question of the consultants. Essentially, Enbridge started, you know, the big picture here is what wasn't being portrayed. Enbridge is trying to move Canadian tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to a coast. We saw it when TransCanada was trying to move the Keystone XL to bring Canadian tar sands to the Gulf Coast. What Enbridge has been doing is trying to build a network to bring that same oil to the East Coast. And they're using the Great Lakes as a shortcut. What they've done in 2013, they added more than 300,000 barrels a day of oil into these two pipelines that go through Michigan. They did Line 6B, that's the other major pipeline that moves from Chicago to Sarnia. That was the one that ruptured into the Kalamazoo River, spilling almost 1 million gallons. Well, Enbridge said that they would replace that pipeline in 2013. They more than doubled the capacity. So they've already added over 250,000 barrels a day of oil in this other pipeline just 3 years, 3.5 years ago. They also at the same time expanded Line 5, added another 50,000 barrels a day there. So the point here is they've got way more oil than Michigan needs moving through Michigan. It's moving to Montreal for export. We're the shortcut. They're getting Canadian oil to a national market using the Great Lakes as a shortcut. The profit all goes to Canada. It's a Canadian company. This is a really bad deal for Michigan businesses. And when you see it that way, but these contractors did not frame the alternatives that way. They essentially took for a base case that Enbridge just continues to move this extra oil through the Great Lakes. That was a major flaw, I think, in their alternative study.
Peter, how feasible are any of these alternatives?
You know, and that's one of the things we're looking at. I think there were a lot of things discussed, you know, the channel, the tunnel, trucks, barges, alternative routes, you know, north, south. And there's a lot of information to digest there. I would leave it to decision makers to say what route is more preferable in terms of the alternatives. But I think the thing to keep in mind, and it was evident last night, there's really two debates that are going on here. And the consultants were charged with doing an assessment of alternatives to Line 5. And that basically assumes the product needs to get from where it's at to consumers here in Michigan and elsewhere. And then the other debate that's going on is the number of folks that prefer to keep it in the ground, that they would just soon see this line go away and somehow made up in some other means. I think the report made it clear that right now there are no other means of transporting product to where it needs to go here in Michigan and elsewhere that are currently existing. Some new construction is going to need to be had. And I think it's a little bit disingenuous to have the conversation and aim it at the consultants about other means of production, or basically just a complete reduction in oil and gas usage to that group, because that wasn't their task. But that's what this conversation seems to be turning into a little bit.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Willard on line one. Willard from Traverse City. Willard, can you hear us? Are you on the air? Can you hear us okay, Willard? We'll come back to Willard in a second. Garrett, when we talk about these alternatives, how would we even get there? I mean, who even, we're talking about Enbridge being forced to do these, to choose one of these alternatives, or how would this even work?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't think anybody is entirely sure exactly how this would work yet, but presumably there would be some sort of court order that the state would pursue, the Attorney General Schuette or his successor. That, you know, right now the alternative study and the companion risk assessment that was scrapped at the last minute over the conflict of interest hiccup. The point of those were to give the state some sort of scientific and legal justification for making a decision. And so the state, Schuette has said in his 2015 task force report that, you know, it would be an extraordinary act to go to the court and ask for the line to be shut down if it wasn't leaking or there wasn't some sort of clear imminent threat that it would fail. I think in the task force report there were three things that he identified as this is what we would need to show in order to get a court order to have the pipeline shut down, and you would have to basically go that route before you could force any of these Enbridge to take on a construction project like building a new pipeline. Essentially, Enbridge has to have been in clear violation of the 1953 easement or other state laws. There's got to be an imminent threat that the pipeline will fail, and that threat has to, and in quotes, outweigh any interest Enbridge has in continuing to operate the pipeline. So that's a pretty tall order in terms of going to the court and getting a judge to say, okay, Enbridge, you have to stop this. You have to shut this pipeline down right now. And they would obviously fight that. And, you know, it's a huge company with, significant resources. And so, you know, I mean, the state is not going to go that route unless it's got some sort of some very real firm, solid ground to stand on.
Peter, what kind of power does the state have to force Enbridge to do something?
That's a good question. I don't think it's clear yet. I think from folks like Jim and some of the other groups that are out there, clear that the state has an interest in the easements that have been granted, and they may be able to do something with that. But in terms of forcing an alternative on a company and something that they would have to do, whether it's a huge capital project like a brand new line, I would doubt that they have the authority to force that type of effort. What would be more likely is, one of the things that the report pointed out is that the channel and a tunnel both have tremendous effects on the operation of the line in terms of spill response, leak detection, containment, that type of issue. What would be more likely is that they may come to them and say, would you be willing to pursue one of these enhancements or one of these other means in an effort to protect, you know, the asset? And they may be willing to take a look at something like that. I would defer to them on what their thoughts are. To me, that seems to be the most likely outcome, because in the report and in the assessment and the risk assessment, you know, decommissioning the line removes all risk to the lake entirely. But the second choice is that tunnel option, which basically marks any risk as negligible or non-existent. And I guess what would be the opposition then to going that route when you know you've got a more safe product, a more safe avenue? My guess is all the folks that are in opposition to the current line would probably be in opposition to a tunnel as well. And for what? I guess I don't understand that portion of it, because the risks are about the same. So there are some options. It would be interesting to see how this rolls out and what the response is from folks in positions to make those type of decisions.
Jim, yeah, go ahead.
Just to really clarify why the state of Michigan has an interest and is involved in this, because in almost all cases, it's a federal issue to regulate oil pipelines. The only reason that the state of Michigan is involved here is because of the crossing of the Straits of Mackinac. That 4.7 miles of Great Lakes bottomlands is controlled, the public trust duty is the state of Michigan to protect that for the citizens and the residents of Michigan and the Great Lakes region.
Is that where the authority to the state, in your interpretation, that's where it comes from?
The Attorney General has said as well. They recognized, it took them a while through that first task force report to realize that Michigan has that authority. They granted an easement to allow Enbridge, Lakehead back then, to use the bottomlands of the Great Lakes. And it's only at the leisure of the state of Michigan that that pipeline resides there. And if Michigan determines that the risk to the Great Lakes is too great, which we believe it is, they can, revoke the easement and say it's not safe. We're not going to allow you to risk the Great Lakes. So as Garrett pointed out, that's the bar there. But it is it's our governor and our attorney general that make that call. Is the risk too great to the Great Lakes? And that's ultimately what it is. And it's becoming a pretty important issue here as we move forward with this next election.
Is there a precedent for this kind of action by a state on primarily a federal issue of interstate commerce?
There's no precedent for an oil pipeline being shut down without the industry's support, I can tell you that. So in that sense, this is very unique. It hasn't happened yet, but clearly Michigan has a unique opportunity or a unique authority, I guess, at the Straits of Mackinac that it's that compelling interest of protecting the interest of the Great Lakes, the public trust duty, the obligation that really never goes away and definitely supersedes any contractual easement that they may have granted in 1953 at a time when, frankly, we knew a lot less about the catastrophic effects of what can happen with an oil spill.
Jim, Peter said one thing that I want to ask you about. Is a tunnel, putting this thing under a tunnel, literally building a tunnel under the bottomlands, would you accept that?
It's interesting to talk about this. I'm surprised that it's coming forward. We had a debate here in Michigan back in 2001, 2002 about slant drilling under the Great Lakes. This was during the Engler administration. Republican legislature was looking at the idea of drilling for oil in the Great Lakes. That was deemed too risky. But the idea then was, maybe we could slant drill under the lakes. And it was looked at as maybe a technological compromise. But the politics of that issue were recognized to be way too risky. We don't go in on or under the Great Lakes. We had a Republican legislature ban any slant drilling under the Great Lakes, which in my opinion essentially is a precedent that says we will not accept any oil in on or under the Great Lakes. That would include a tunnel.
Let's talk about the risk analysis. The alternatives analysis was supposed to be coupled with this risk analysis, looking at, what's the actual risk of a rupture and what are possible rupture scenarios. It was supposed to come out at the same time, but it didn't. Garrett, what happened?
Right, basically at the 11th hour, the state got an email from one of their contractors, maybe a liaison of some sort between the State Pipeline Advisory Board team that was basically heading up this project to get these studies completed, and the contractor at DNVGL. That they were doing the risk analysis.
And this is a different company that
right. It's not
the alternatives.
It's a I think it's a Norwegian company with an American division, and essentially the email said, we've discovered that there's a guy who's working on a similar hydrodynamic modeling project for Enbridge, and it's been going on for several months. I believe since January. And the state only found out just before the last Pipeline Safety Advisory Board meeting, the one in June in Petoskey. So they really kind of deliberated quickly and ultimately decided that any appearance of conflict of interest or impropriety was just not worth you know, not worth it, and terminated the contract. There were clauses in the contract that allowed them to do it. I think you saw last night at the pipeline, or at the meeting with the dynamic risk folks over the alternative study, that the public was much more interested in the risk assessment than they were the alternatives. The public is still trying to collectively get its mind wrapped around the potential risk scenario of what might happen were this pipeline to burst. What exactly is the worst case scenario versus the best case scenario?
But it sounds like in the alternative study, some of this was done.
Yeah, they did. They did a risk assessment in order to develop a baseline risk assessment to compare to the different alternatives and sort of grade them, each alternative, in that manner, right? So they considered an oil spill in the Straits of Mackinac as the baseline of risk. And okay, so it's going to be this bad and it's going to cost this much. And so we're going to evaluate options A, B, C, and D, new pipelines elsewhere, right, essentially, based on how bad or how risky they are in comparison to an oil spill in the Great Lakes. So that was, they didn't set out, you know, their task was to do alternatives, but part of that was a risk assessment. I guess, you know, according to David Schwab, the U of M scientist who conducted what's considered to be by many the most credible oil spill modeling of a spill in the Straits of Mackinac, he talked to me after the meeting last night, and he's like, it was a great thing that they did that, because now they provided the state of Michigan with a risk assessment that suddenly they didn't have before, because this other study got scrapped at the last minute.
Is the state going to find another firm to do another risk analysis report? Do we know what's going to happen?
You know, they haven't said they're going to do that. They said they're talking about it. So there's some discussion. They may or they may not. I think that if they were to do that, there would be significant pushback on the part of groups and citizens that don't want to see this process delayed any further.
Jim, what do you think of the way the state has handled this conflict of interest situation?
They're in a tough spot. There really are no experts out there that are experts on oil pipelines that don't work for the oil industry. So I get the conflicts are embedded in the whole process. That doesn't mean that they're not there. And I think we need to be aware that, you know, the folks that are in the industry think about the industry. They think that's where their next job's coming from. So they're definitely worried about maintaining the industry rather than thinking about alternatives and other ways to do business. You know, one example I'd like to go back to, because it's been talked about quite a bit and really mischaracterized, is this issue of propane in the UP. We've heard so much about how vital Line 5 is for the propane in the UP. What we heard last night, and what has actually been described earlier but has been lost, it's a 540,000 barrels a day of product moves through that line. 2,000 gallons per day of that, less than 0.5%, is propane to the UP. It is not a vital part of Enbridge's business model to provide propane to the UP. It has become a convenient thing for them to talk about the need for propane in the UP. And what we learned last night is a simple 4-inch natural gas pipeline along the same corridor could handle this very quickly and easily. It's not a big deal. They've made it a big deal to try to justify keeping this risky pipeline in a really bad spot.
Peter, who's right on this propane issue?
You know, I had the good fortune of speaking with a propane provider up in the Upper Peninsula who was operating 3 years ago when prices spiked to 200 or 300% of what they usually were. Propane may not be vital to Enbridge's business, but it's vital to the citizens of the Upper Peninsula and northern Lower Michigan. So to dismiss it like that out of hand is a little bit disingenuous, and I don't think it does service to the folks that had to endure those shortages 2 or 3 years ago and had to experience those cost increases.
At a certain point, it
became dismissive. People were having a tough time filling their 200-pound propane tank because product wasn't available. You take Line 5 out of commission, those folks have got to find another source, and any other source but a pipeline is going to be more dangerous than what's currently existing. So I take that with a grain of salt, what Jim had to say.
We heard last night, Peter, a simple 4-inch natural gas pipeline would take care of this. They replaced Line 6B in a matter of a few months. The easement's there. This is a simple fix. It's being portrayed as if, you know, the UP is being held hostage. We can move propane many ways, certainly with a pipeline.
And if the economics of that supported that decision, that'd be fine. But I guess your comment that it's not significant to Michigan
to Enbridge.
Is a little bit disingenuous. It may be insignificant to Enbridge, but again, it's not to the people of the Upper Peninsula and Northern Lower Michigan that rely on that line for propane.
I don't think it's fair to put them in the crosshairs and make them the reason that we're risking the Great Lakes. That's not fair.
Okay.
Well, I completely agree. It also goes hand in hand with your comment that Michigan doesn't benefit from that line. And again, I think it is unfair because 65% of the propane in the Upper Peninsula comes through that line, 55% of the propane for the state of Michigan. And Michigan is the largest propane user in the country. So any dip in that supply for those consumers could be difficult.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Willard. Willard is back on line one. Willard, you're on the air.
Great afternoon.
Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
My question is, the Great Lakes represents 20% of the entire world's water, fresh water, for human consumption. So when the pipeline breaks, with all these other factors that could happen, possibilities, you know, man-made. Anyways, when the pipeline breaks, where is everyone that relies on the fresh water from the Great Lakes going to migrate to?
Willard, this is Garrett. Where do you live?
Traverse City, Michigan.
Okay. From the different scenarios that I've seen of a pipeline burst, you know, the Straits of Mackinac do seem to be the epicenter for where the worst of the oil is going to be. So anybody living in, a 50 mile or more radius right around the bridge is going to be getting the worst of it. in Traverse City, I think if a pipeline like this were to burst, immediate steps would be taken to, guard with the water intake for the city that underneath East Bay, that sort of thing. Elsewhere in the Great Lakes, the oil from this is not going to, it isn't going to get to Lake Ontario. It's not going to get to Lake Erie. It's certainly not going to get to Lake Superior. So, you have to think of a pipeline break in this area is indeed a catastrophic event, and it's something that all efforts should be taken to avoid. But you have to consider the geographic proximity to the the actual event. It isn't like the Detroit water system is suddenly going to be inundated with oil. It's just too far away.
Jim,
can
ahead.
I just jump in quick? Because, I appreciate Willard's point. We are concerned about the impact, direct impact to drinking water systems in Charlevoix and even Traverse City, which gets its water. But I think what's more important that we all recognize is Northern Michigan, we are the heart of Pure Michigan. And in fact, the Pure Michigan campaign, the heart of that is the Straits of Mackinac. So much of our business in Michigan is dependent on tourism and this image of clean, pure Michigan. And when we have the threat of an oil spill, much less a potential actual catastrophe happening in the Great Lakes, people that come here don't really know where the Straits of Mackinac are and how far that oil went. What they know is that the Great Lakes just got polluted, and the impact on the businesses in this region would be truly catastrophic. That's why we've started a Great Lakes Business Network. We have more than 60 business members that are expressing their very deep concern about this oil pipeline operating and risking their business for the profit of a Canadian company exporting oil overseas when we get the risk and they're getting the profit. It's not a good deal for the businesses of Michigan.
You're listening to a live call-in program on IPR News Radio, and we want to hear from you this hour. Please call in with your question for our panel. The number is 800-681-5929, 800-681-5929. Peter, The specter of an oil spill is something that's actually happened in Michigan recently. In 2010, there was a massive spill along Enbridge's Line 6B near Kalamazoo in Marshall, Michigan. How has the oil industry responded after that catastrophe?
You know, in terms of the industry's response, I think it's consistent as ever, which is find the best technology, find the best techniques to maintain and protect the pipelines and the economic and environmental damage that could ensue if there was a damage. But I think specifically with Enbridge, and you would have to ask them directly, I certainly can't speak for them, but I would say that I got to believe that their process and procedure for what's been going on in terms of in Michigan and specifically with Line 5, it's my understanding that Line 5 is the most monitored line in the country right now in terms of how it's viewed, how it's monitored, how the operations are taken up. I think as an industry, the technology is growing at such a rate where, you know, you can run an inline inspection tool through a pipeline that can determine metal density, it can determine any type of corrosion, any type of dents, any other issues that could occur at a pipeline. And that technology is only growing. It's getting better and better. I think that's what the consultants last night were talking about a little bit more is, and it can only get safer. And where they're going with their monitoring, it should be a model for the rest of the country in terms of how they're treating this line. I had the good fortune of touring the Line 5 area this past week, and talking to their head of operations up there. And they do more for the community up in that area than I ever anticipated. You know, I've heard and seen some of the press releases, but talking to their head of operations, Joe, a great guy, and I'd recommend, you know, if you can take some time to tour, it sounds like Garrett already has. There's a level of comfort and security you have knowing the people that are running that operation because they care about the community. So I guess technology, care, concern, and policy changes since the Marshall spill, I feel more comfortable, and I would say, you know, that's for you to decide and for you to take up on your own, but I think it's an important step in the process.
Jim, what do you think of the way that Enbridge has responded in the last 7 years?
Well, boy, their concern and the amount of money that they're putting into communities around Michigan is definitely elevated. Clearly, they feel the concern from the residents of Michigan. I think one of the things we haven't talked about, and it wasn't the scope of the consultants last night, but is the risk from the rest of that Line 5 pipeline. You know, there's a lot of attention focused on the 4.7 miles in the Straits of Mackinac, as there should be. That's where the real risk is concentrated. But that pipeline follows the shoreline of Lake Michigan through the Upper Peninsula for dozens of miles, really close to the shoreline, and that is a 64-year-old, not a well-maintained, not a extra thick pipeline that is already leaked. I believe it's 29 times. So the risk of Enbridge having another catastrophic oil spill elsewhere on Line 5 is becoming greater by the day. And all of this, you know, major attention that's being focused on the Straits is not looking elsewhere, where there really are significant risks.
Jim, could you be convinced that Line 5 is safe based on the state's investigation?
I'll tell you, and Garrett sat there with me, the engineering analysis last night about the safety of the, or the condition of the pipe, I'm not sure I was convinced, I'm not sure I understood it, but they definitely made a case that they can tell a lot about the integrity of the pipeline. What they also said is that there are things that happen outside the pipeline that are outside of Enbridge's control, things like terrorism, things like you know, the anchor drag and the currents that are unpredictable. Those are the kinds of things that they said are much more likely to cause this pipe to break. And that's just because of the location of this pipe. As Dr. Schwab said, it is the absolute worst place to put a pipeline, and that's right where it sits. So I'm not going to be convinced that it's ever safe in that location. It's just too risky.
And Peter, I guess my question for you is, could you be convinced that it needs to be removed?
Oh, I think the alternatives analysis, one of the things that made clear is there is risk. For me, you know, I guess, could it be removed? Absolutely, it could be removed. But I look at the alternatives, and you still need to get product from where it's at to where the consumers are. I mean, what I looked around after I left the meeting last night is there wasn't a whole lot of bicycles and there weren't a whole lot of solar-powered vehicles out in the parking lot. People drove to that meeting, which means they use gasoline. So they need the product. I guess the question would be, if you had the opportunity to make it safer, like a tunnel, like the channel, why wouldn't you want the latest and greatest technology involved in that pipeline rather than just saying we're going to hope and pray that there's another means to get product to the folks so that they can turn on their lights in the morning and get to work in their car? I guess that would be my response.
Pete, can I jump in? You know, this is Garrett. I think it's worth noting there that, you know, to suggest that nobody's going to be able to heat their home or drive, will have to rely on bicycles or, you know, that's a bit of a straw man argument there. You know, this report did say that the price of propane could rise by up to 35 cents in the UP, and the price of refined petroleum, essentially gasoline, throughout the state would go up by about 2 cents. I think it's unanswered right now as to what the effect on Michigan consumers, outside of some propane users in the UP, what the effect on Michigan consumers really is were this pipeline to be shut down. It's not known how much of the product is offloaded in Detroit and then used in Michigan. That wasn't part of the report. And that's not anywhere in any public document that I've seen yet. And Enbridge hasn't said that. And I think at the top of the hour, you heard Ryan Duffy saying, well, 30% of the oil in the line goes to the Detroit refinery. Well, does that refinery then, is that 30% of that product then go straight into the supply of gasoline for Michigan? Does it go to Ohio? Does it go across the border again? So there's unanswered questions here in regards to exactly mm-hmm. what the people of Michigan get out of this pipeline.
All right, let's go back. Let's get another caller. Let's go to Joanne on line three. Joanne, you're on the air. What's your question?
Thanks. Well, I wanted to point out something. Flow technical experts concluded that no more than 5 to 10% of the light crude oil carried by line five is destined for the Detroit or two Toledo refineries, with the remaining 90 to 95% reaching refineries in Sarnia, Ontario. That's one point. So I'd like them to address that. But also, if Line 5 is shut down, a viable alternative for propane supplier planes, All American, could be shipped using 4 to 5 tanker trucks daily, or 1 to 2 rail cars could deliver propane from Superior to Escanaba, Rapid River, and beyond. So if this is not true, I'd like the documentation because we've done a lot of work on this.
Peter, is there? I guess we're getting ahead of ourselves talking about alternatives to alternatives. But is there a way we could move this propane on truck or rail?
That's a good question. I don't know the capacity. Joanne said that they've done a lot of work in the research, and I don't know who that is. But the conversation last night was to move the total volume that moves through line five. It would take one tanker truck leaving every 40 seconds, 24 hours a day, which is 3,200 trucks around the clock every day.
That was oil.
I don't know what percentage of that would be. That's total product, and I understand that. I don't know what the total quantity of propane is. I know that the existing infrastructure doesn't exist right now to move that propane where it needs to go through the UP, so something new would have to be in the works. So I don't think I'm equipped to answer how many propane tankers it would take to move that or how many rail cars. I'd be interested in seeing where she got her research from.
Yeah, we've seen about 2 to 3 rail cars could take care of that. And again, what we learned last night is a simple 4-inch propane or natural gas pipeline could take care of that as well. You know, that's what Enbridge is in the business of, is building pipelines.
All right, let's take another caller, Jerry in Harbor Springs. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi. Should there be a leak, what are the state and the oil company ready? Did they have something in place to address the leak so it doesn't get out of hand?
Thanks, Jerry. Garrett?
You know, there
I'd be happy to take this one since I just toured the facility, if you want.
All right, we'll go to you next after Garrett, okay. Peter.
Yeah, there are spill, you know, the Enbridge is required to have a spill response plan, and there's, you know, various debates over the robustness of that plan, but there is a plan in place. I do know last year, having gone up to a meeting involving the EPA and the Coast Guard and PHMSA, that at that meeting, the Coast Guard essentially said that they are not completely ready in terms of certain techniques that would need to be employed to, for instance, burning off oil. There's a lot yet to be done in order to get certain spill recovery practices in place. There is some debate about whether there's enough what's called vessels of opportunity in the area, basically boats large enough to tow oil recovery equipment. The Coast Guard would essentially be in charge of this because the EPA has jurisdiction on land versus the Coast Guard offshore. But, you know, the shorter answer to your question is, yeah, there is a plan in place. The debate over, you know, whether that plan is adequate is, you know, what's ongoing.
Peter, would you like to respond or would you like to add something?
I was going to say Garrett's response was perfect, and sounds like after having toured it, he's seen some of the same equipment I have. On site, actually, at the Straits facility, they've got different materials that are designed to capture and to contain and then capture product were it to spill out, including in open water along the coastlines and in an ice recovery. They've got a tremendous amount of equipment there, and I think their relationship with the first responders, both in St. Ignace and in Mackinac City, is indicative of the seriousness that they put on making sure that they've got the right resources in place. I've talked to up in Mackinac City a couple of first responder folks, and they're very pleased with the relationship they've got with Enbridge and how much that they've worked to make sure that they've got the tools necessary should something go wrong.
Real quick, at best they describe 30% recovery to be a success. So they expect to lose 70% of that oil to the environment. They really have very little to say about ice recovery. It's a guess what they would do under ice. And, this is where the worst case scenario really needs to be discussed, because I don't believe these first responders are at all ready for a major oil spill in that spot.
Yeah, there's some question of whether they would have to come from Detroit or Chicago. I did see a recent Coast Guard report that says their capabilities for ice winter recovery options are getting better, but they're not quite ready. They're not quite there yet.
We've just got a couple minutes left. Garrett, what possible developments should we look for in the next few months?
Well, the alternative study is out for draft. What's out there is a draft. The state wants people to comment on it. They want a lot of feedback. They want feedback that is technical and thoughtful, more than just shut the pipeline down. So if you're an engineer or, you know, a scientist, or, you know, you have some sort of other expert opinion on it, that, you know, that's kind of what they're looking for. That's until August 4th. And then all of that feedback gets sent to Dynamic Risk, which will bake it into the final report. And then that's what the state will use to decide this fall what they're going to do. Do they recommend that the pipeline be shut down? Do they recommend, you know, doing nothing? And then, you know, there's a legislative component to this. There are, you know, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle that would like to see this pipeline shut down. Bills to that effect really haven't gone anywhere yet. So, you know, that's something to keep an eye on. There's a petition out there that would potentially, if it gets enough signatures, could prohibit oil from flowing through the line, would turn it just into a propane or, you know, liquid natural gas line. But, you know, I think a lot of people are expecting at the end of all of this it to end up in court at some point here in the next, you know, some year or two.
Peter, do you think we're headed for court?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I think we're headed for a robust public debate and public discussion about the importance of making sure that Michiganders have access to low-cost gas and natural gas, and the importance of energy infrastructure, whether it is petroleum pipelines or electric lines, and what's going to keep the state running. In that sense, what I would say is, if you're a concerned citizen and if you've got an interest in this issue, go and read the report. the debate last night, the discussion last night, the presentation from the engineers was highly technical, but I think the report, especially the executive summary and some of the detailed appendices, are written in pretty plain language that most folks can understand. And I would say if you care about the issue and you care about the topic, read the report rather than listen to, you know, somebody like me who works for the industry, or someone like Jim who lives, you know, who works in opposition to Line 5. Make your own decisions.
Jim, what will you be looking for over the next few months?
Well, I'll echo what Garrett said, is this is the time really for Michigan residents who are concerned about this issue to let their voices be heard. Right now, the state is asking for you to comment and tell them what you think. We have a one-month window, and it's so important that the state hear from residents. Granted, I agree with you, Peter. People need to read that report. There's parts of it that you can easily understand. The part that says decommissioning that pipeline is a feasible alternative is worth reading, because we don't need to accept this risk in the Straits, but we need people to comment. And so if you have questions, you can find that report online. If you go to the oilandwaterdontmix.org website, you'll get some help in looking where to look at the different alternatives and some of the facts. But please take this opportunity and do comment on the Line 5 pipeline.
We're out of time today. I want to thank our guests, Garrett Ellison with MLive. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jim Lively with the Groundwork Center. Nice to have you in.
Yeah, thanks, David.
And Peter Langley with the Associated Petroleum Industries of Michigan. Peter, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate the opportunity.
This has been special programming on IPR News Radio. Thank you to the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism, which was a sponsor for this program. Max Johnston helped produce the show this hour. Morgan Springer ran the phones, and Aaron Selbig was our engineer. I'm David Castleman. This is IPR News Radio, WICA, Traverse City, 91.5 FM, WLMN, Manistee, Ludington, 89.7 FM, and WHBP, Harbor Springs, Petoskey, 90.1 FM. Online at iprnews.org. Have a good weekend. It's 2 o'clock.